You would open up your Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 18. 2 Samuel chapter 18. I guess I'll say if Drake and Audrey are watching, congratulations on the birth of your daughter, Eva. I know we've been praying for you as a church. I'm sure we have, and praying for little Eva. And it's good to know that now we can call Paula grandma without getting punched. Well, we still may get hit. You're right. Praying for you. Be looking forward to seeing you back and looking forward to it. So we are in chapter 18 of 2 Samuel. This is what we call the battle in the forest of Ephraim. The battle in the forest of Ephraim. And this battle has been building for about three chapters now. You know, way back in chapter 15 is when Absalom kind of began his campaign. You know, to win the hearts of the men of Israel, to win the hearts over to himself. You know, he had all these chariots and these men that ran before him. He would go sit at the gate and if I was king, you know, your case is good. And if I was king, I'd see to it that you got a favorable ruling. You know, just trying to create dissatisfaction with David and win the hearts of the people over to himself. And then he goes to his father David and he deceitfully tells him he's going to make an offering in Geshur. David allows him to go. He takes several men with him, and as he gets there, that's when he begins to initiate his revolt. David hears that the men of Israel are after, or the hearts of the men of Israel have gone after Absalom, so David, fearing for his life, leaves Jerusalem. With probably less than 1,000 men, he leaves Jerusalem. Gets to the end of Jerusalem, he stops by, watches all the men kind of pass before him. They get down to the foot of the hill. He sends the ark and the priest back. He climbs the Mount of Olives. They're all weeping and sobbing and barefoot and their heads covered. Get to the top of the hill. He runs into his friend, you know, and he tells him, look, I want you, don't go with me. I want you to stay behind and defeat the council of Ahithophel. So he goes on down the hill. He runs into Shimeah, who's cursing him all the way down as he goes, throwing dirt and rocks. So it's just, you know, David, he's going through a lot, and he finally gets down here, and as he's leaving, you seemingly have Absalom coming right behind him, you know, filling the void in Jerusalem. He gets counsel from Ahithophel, who was David, his father's counselor at the time, and friend. He gets counsel from him to go into his father's concubines. He does that very thing. Then he asks, okay, now what's our next step? Next step, Ahithophel says, is I'm going to go tonight with 12,000 men, and I'm going to kill David, and I'll bring all the people back to you. Okay, let's see what Hushai the Archite has to say. Hushai says, no. They're enraged. They're men of war. They'll destroy us, and word will come back, and the people's heart will melt. They know your father is such a great warrior. Absalom, they know this. You know this. So my advice is this. My advice is we gather a massive army that's as massive as the sand on the seashore, from the north to the south, from Dan to Beersheba. We amass this army. You lead it. Don't let Ahithophel, you know, get the glory. You lead this army. And we'll go and we'll light on him as the dew lights on the ground of the morning, and we'll kill everybody. Not just David. We'll kill everybody who hasn't followed and bowed the knee to Absalom. And that seems to be the advice that Absalom, well, it is the advice that Absalom followed, probably most likely because it fed his ego. So David had these men in place who were sent to go and tell him what was going on, and these secret messengers or spies, they run for their life. They're almost caught at one point. They're covered up in a well. They escape that danger. They give the message to David. David crosses the Jordan. He gets on the other side of the Jordan, and he comes to Mahanaim. And in chapter 17, which was last week, he gets this help from these men in that foreign country, really. These men kind of give him food and beans and grain and beds, and, you know, because the people are hungry and weary and thirsty, and they kind of refresh David. David's now refreshed. He's a little bit encouraged. The shock has worn off. He's regrouped, and he has a massive army when we get to chapter one, verse 1 of chapter 18. So as we get there, I'll read 18 verses 1 through 5. Then David mustered the men who were with him and set over the commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And David sent out the army, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the men, I myself will also go out with you. But the men said, you shall not go out, for if we flee, they will not care about us. And if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us, for it is better that you send us help from the city. Then the king said to them, whatever seems best to you, I will do. So the king stood at the side of the gate while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, the commanders, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all the commanders about Absalom. So David, you know, he sets up, you know, he's a great military general. And he sets these commanders up over these three groups and three factions. You got Joab, you got Abishai, and you got Ittai the Gittite. He sets these men up and he says, I'm going to go with you. And they said, no, David, we don't want you to go with us. And they're right, because they were going to seek David's life, and David's life would have been probably what would have caused the whole kingdom to come unraveled at that point. David was God's man. And so that's why I think they said, no, David, you stay here. You can help us more from the city by sending us, you know, support from the city. So David stands by, and then David says something kind of strange here in verse 5. He says, look, I want you to deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. So David gives orders here really as a father, not necessarily as a king. As if he and Absalom had some little minor quarrel that could be corrected with an apology. He failed to see Absalom as a traitor and as a rebel. And he failed to see how Absalom's action has caused a great deal of harm to the kingdom. And it caused a loss of life. They're fixing to lose 20,000 men right here. But deal gently with Absalom. But David's orders resonated with the troops. You know, when we get down to verse 12, Absalom has been called, and I don't mean to get ahead of myself, but one of the young men doesn't kill Absalom when he has the opportunity. And he says, no, no, no. I heard the king. I heard David tell you, protect the young man Absalom. So they heard it. It wasn't as if David just half-heartedly said it. He said it, and it stuck with the people. When they were fighting, that was on their mind. And the first question, when word comes back about the battle in verse 29, the first question David says is it well with my young man Absalom? So these orders were clear. They were not wise, but they were clear. There's a commentator by the name of Adar says this, David is sending out the people to risk their life for him and his throne, while on the other hand, he's asking that his son, who is the root of all the evil, be spared. Odd. Now, like I said, this battle's been building for at least three chapters, but it's funny how the author of this only gives us three verses on the battle itself. 6 through 8, we're going to describe the battle. So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David. And the loss was a great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. So that's the description of the battle. It seems so the army, David's army, had advanced into the field against Israel. And against Israel as being those who followed Absalom. The battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim. Now there's a lot of people argue for a long time about where that's at. I'm not real geographically keen on where all these places are over there, so I don't know. But it seems like it's on the east side of the Jordan, because David was camped out in Mahanaim, and when he left out the city, they went to this forest to fight. The battleground seems to be chosen by David at this point. And when Israel was defeated by David's warriors, it sustained a loss of 20,000 men. 20,000 men. And in verse 8, it says something again that's interesting. The battle spread over the face of the whole country. The forest devoured more people that day than the sword. That's kind of an odd statement. So, but whether it was the terrain and the less experienced warriors, they just fell prey to maybe all the ravines, the cliffs, or the branches, or the briars, something along those lines seemed to kill or devour more people than the sword did that day. Now, if we were to go back to Joshua 10, and I'm not asking you to, the people of Joshua were in a battle that day, and it says this in Joshua 10, verse 11. And as they fled before Israel, while they were going down the ascent of Beth Horon, the Lord threw down large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. So there were more who died because of the hailstones than the sons of Israel killed with the sword. We have that in Joshua. We also have in 2 Kings 19:35, it says that the Lord used an angel. An angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 men in the camp of the Assyrians. So when the people of Israel rose early in the morning, they were all these dead bodies. So whether the Lord used an angel as he did in 2 Kings, or he used hailstones as he did in Joshua, or as he seems to use here, the forest of Ephraim, there's more people killed in the by the forest of Ephraim than it was by the hand of the sword. Now, some commentators would try to stress that means wild beast in the forest. I don't necessarily believe that. I think you kind of have to read into it to think that. I think it's just the terrain itself and maybe some of the obstacles that they were just less experienced. So they probably were put to flight early on in this battle and were just running scared and ran into danger. That seems to be the way it reads in my mind. So, like I said, this battle really is only summed up in three verses here. But the account of Absalom as he encounters David's men, the account of Absalom as he flees and then is slain or killed, takes up nine verses. So there seems to be more emphasis put on that. So I'll read 9 through 18, or 9 through 15. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Just so happened. We read that a lot. Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under thick branches of the great oak. And his head was caught fast in the oak. And he was suspended between heaven and earth while the mule that was under him went on. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in oak." Joab said to the man who told him, "What, you saw him? Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." But the man said to Joab, "Even if I felt the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if I dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof." Joab said, "I will not waste time like this with you." And he took 3 javelins in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. So, there's really nothing, as we read this, I know where your mind goes because mine goes there too, and there's really nothing said to support the idea, which seems to have originated with Josephus, that he was hung by his long hair. No, it says his head got caught fast in the oak. Now, some translations actually translated his head. And that word could be head if you were to look at how that word is used, the Hebrew word is used throughout the Bible. But it's used as head more common than hair. I might have said that backwards a while ago, but I think you know what I meant. So, as Joab is hung by his head, and I do believe it's his hair myself, but I couldn't make a case for it, it seems that the very thing which was a symbol of his pride became his downfall. You know, he would let his hair grow out for a solid year, and then he would go cut it in some public spectacle and bring it in here and just show the crowds. I think his hair weighed about 5 pounds, you know. He got his money's worth when he went to the hairstylist. But so he would, the very thing that was a symbol of his pride became his downfall. That's common. And then we get to verse 10, it says, a certain man saw it. And then he says, I saw him. And Joab seems to be frustrated that he didn't kill him. And the young man's like, look, I heard what the king said. Even if you were to give me 10,000 pieces of silver, I wouldn't have killed him. Because if I would have killed him, Joab, you wouldn't have took up for me. You would have stood at a distance and called me out on it. And more likely, that's exactly what would have happened. But we don't, that's speculation at this point. So Joab says in verse 14, I just think it's interesting the way he just reads this, I will not waste time with you like this. You're wasting my time. Whether he's talking about you're wasting my time arguing with you, or just get out of here, let me take care of this. And so he seems to brush this young man off, and then he took 3 javelins in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom. Now, the heart of Absalom doesn't necessarily have to be his heart. It could be anywhere in his midsection, but he thrust these 3 spears into Absalom. But yet, even that, probably that was a fatal blow, but that he still doesn't seem to be dead at this point because it seems that these 10 young men surround Absalom and strike him and kill him. So Joab was not going to let this opportunity pass him by. And he was convinced at this point, Joab was convinced that it was in David's best interest to put Absalom to death. Joab did not hesitate to strike Absalom. Now, your mind can go in 1,000 different directions on why Joab did this. You know, one thing could be he was kind of angered and embarrassed over the fact he was the one, Joab was the very one who insisted that David bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. You remember Absalom had ran and hid in Geshur. And David, you know, even went to the point of getting a woman from Tekoa to come and tell this story, this parable, and got David to kind of buy into the idea and to bring Absalom back to Jerusalem. So it was Joab who risked his, you know, who stuck his neck on the line to bring Absalom back. He had been the chief advocate for Absalom, going to great lengths, you know, including the woman at Tekoa, to reunite the father and son. And how does Absalom return the favor of Joab? Well, he sets his fields on fire when Joab won't answer him. I called for you, and you didn't answer me, so I just set your fields on fire. So how does Absalom return the favor of his father? He did so by creating resentment between the people and his father. He did so by eventually stealing the hearts of the men of Israel away from his father. That's how he repaid his father. Now, there's something that happens at the end of David's life that I think I kind of tied back into this. And I need to remind you of something. I need to inform you of something before we go forward. I'm reminding you that right when David became king in Hebron, there was a man, there was a descendant of Saul by the name of Ishbosheth, who Abner had set up to be the king. You remember Abner was Ishbosheth's commander of his army. And he set Ishbosheth up as king. Of course, over here, David was king in Hebron, and David should have been king over the entire kingdom, but they refused. They still clung on to that line of Saul. And so Abner gets into a tussle, so to speak, with Ishbosheth, and he just goes over to David, pledges all his allegiance to David. Right? Joab hears about this, and Joab is furious that David let Abner go. So Joab basically tracks down Abner, the commander of Ishbosheth's army, and puts him to death. Okay, last week we read that Absalom had set a young man by the name of Amasa, or Amasa, as commander of his army. So if we were to read 2 Samuel 19:13, it says this. This is David speaking. "And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? God do so to me, and more also, if you are not commander over my army from now on in place of Joab." So after this battle was over with, David sets Absalom's commander, Amasa, over Joab. And I don't want to spoil it, but they don't sit well with Joab. Joab tracks this man down and kills him too. Okay? So I say that to at the end of David's life, he says this in 1 Kings 2. He says, I think he's talking to Solomon, his son, at this point. He says, "I want you to know that Joab, the son of Zeruiah, did to me, and how he dealt with the two commanders of the armies of Israel, Abner, the son of Ner, and Amasa, the son of Jether, whom he killed." Talking about Joab killed him. "Avenging in times of peace for blood that had been shed in war, and for putting the blood of war on his belt, around his waist, and on the sandals of his feet. Therefore, act accordingly to your wisdom, but do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace." So, David really gives Solomon some instruction at the end of his life. Do away with Joab. And the two reasons he gives is Joab kills Abner and Joab kills Amasa. But he doesn't even say anything about Joab killed your brother. I told Joab not to kill Absalom, but Joab did. You know, when your brother was basically hanging defenseless in a tree, Joab killed him. But that, for some reason, David doesn't address it. I don't know if it has to do with in times of peace and this was war, and if this was war, then Joab was justified in killing Absalom. Maybe that's why. I just thought it was strange. So we'll pick up and we'll move on. We're in chapter 18, verse 16. "So after Absalom was struck and killed, Joab blew the trumpet. And the troops came back from pursuing Israel, and Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a great heap of stones, and all Israel fled, everyone to his own home. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken up and set up for himself a pillar that is in the king's valley, for he said, 'I have no son to keep my name in remembrance.' He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day." So it says here that he said he has no son to keep his name in remembrance. But if you remember a couple chapters back, in 2 Samuel 14, we read where Absalom had three sons and one daughter, and he named that daughter Tamar after his sister. So it's odd that his three sons aren't named, but yet the daughter is. Most commentators take that to mean that Absalom's three sons must have died in infancy or at a young age, and so he didn't have one to precede him. Maybe that's what most commentators take that verse 18 to mean there. So we'll move on. I'll read 19 through 23. "Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, 'Let me run and carry to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies.' And Joab said to the king," I'm sorry, "and Joab said to him," Ahimaaz, "'You are not to carry the news today. You may carry news another day, but today you shall carry no news because the king's son is dead.' Then Joab said to the Cushite, 'Go tell the king what you have seen.' The Cushite bowed before Joab and ran, and Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, 'Come what may, let me also run after the Cushite.' And Joab said, 'Why will you run, my son, seeing that you will have no reward for the news? Come what may, I will run.' So he said to him, 'Run.' Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite." So Ahimaaz was also, if you remember back from last chapter, he was one of the two messengers. It was Ahimaaz and Jonathan. They were the two that were hiding. And when the news came, they were to go tell David, and then they had to hide in a well. Ahimaaz was one of those two men. So he was probably still running on that adrenaline. He had just narrowly escaped his life, gave the message to David, been in battle. "Let me go tell David the good news about the battle." And Joab says, "No, not today, because his son is dead." So he gets this Cushite, and most people think this Cushite is just a slave. just some armor bearer slave that Joab have. He said, just let him go. Let him take him with him. So Joab does not allow Ahimaaz to give the news to David. Maybe Joab knew that this man was too attached. He was too attached to David and to the situation to really be able to give this advice. And honestly, Joab seems to be proven correct. Because as we're going to read in verse 29, when Ahimaaz goes to David, David asks, how is my son? And he can't bear to deliver the news to David. He just can't do it. So Joab does seem to be right. Maybe for the wrong reasons, but he ended up being correct. Sending the Cushite was the one to send. And it says that he outran the Cushite. Now, most people believe that the Cushite took a direct route, kind of through the woods, up over hills, down through the valleys, where Ahimaaz went around the plain. He took the longer route, but actually made it there quicker. No, I guess similar to the way you drive in Birmingham sometimes. Getting on the interstate is the longer route, but it's way quicker than 1,000 red lights. Right, Tim? So we'll read 24 through 30. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall, and when he lifted up his eyes and looked, and he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out and told the king, and the king said, if he is alone, there's news in his mouth. And he drew nearer and nearer, and the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gate and said, see, another man running alone. The king said, he also brings good news. The watchman said, I think he is running. I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he is a good man, and he comes with good news. Then Ahimaaz cried out to the king, all is well. And he bowed before the king with his face to the earth and said, blessed be the Lord your God who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord, the king. And the king said, it is well. Is it well with the young man Absalom? Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, but I do not know what it was. And the king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still. So Ahimaaz was one of the messengers who had barely escaped with his life. And he outruns this Cushite here to give the message to David. And he gets to David and he's going to tell David about the battle. But David seems to care very little about the battle. So David asks about, is it well with the young man Absalom? And you see, Ahimaaz cannot bring himself to tell David in verse 29. No, I saw a great commotion. I don't know what it was. Well, he does know because Joab told him. Joab says, you know, today is not the day, back up in verse 20, you may carry news on another day, but today you shall carry no news because the king's son is dead. So Ahimaaz knew the king's son was dead. He just couldn't bear to tell David. So David says, just stand to the side. And he stood to the side and he waits to see what the news that this Cushite is going to give him. And the Cushite gives him the news in verse 31. And behold, the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, good news for my lord the king. For the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all who rose up against you. And the king said to the Cushite, again, I don't care about the battle. Is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that of that young man, Absalom. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I have died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son. So the Cushite delivers the message he was told to deliver. The battle is won. But again, David doesn't seem interested about the battle. What about Absalom? Absalom is dead. So there it is. If you remember last week, we read in chapter 17, verse 14, it said God had ordained to bring harm to Absalom. Right? So God had ordained to bring harm to Absalom, but yet David had said, protect Absalom. So we knew all along that David's request was going to be denied. David's request to spare Absalom was going to be denied because the Lord had ordained to bring harm to Absalom. And here it all seems to come. But throughout this whole episode, throughout the whole episode that we've read, you've not once seen David call Absalom son. Go up to verse 5. When he's warning the troops as they go out, what's he say? Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Verse 29. He goes again. Is it well with the young man Absalom? He does the same thing again in verse 32. Is it well with the young man Absalom? And then when he's told that Absalom is dead, that's when he just, all them emotions seem to come. He seems to be overrun with regret and sadness and who knows what other feelings, because he starts crying out, my son, my son, my son Absalom. But yet he hadn't referred to Absalom as a son all the way through this. But he tends to, at the end of this thing, really just start crying out for Absalom. Now maybe David was kind of just torn up inside because he knew, Nathan had told him way back in chapter 12 that the sword would never depart from his house. And David knew that it was his sin. It was his sin that lied at the heart of this trouble. It was his sin that caused this. Maybe that's what he means when he said, would I have died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son. So I read that, and just as maybe food for thought, I wondered sometimes, you know, would Adam and Eve, who were living in paradise, you know, they're in the Garden of Eden, walking with the Lord daily, everything's great, and yet they saw something they wanted, they were told they couldn't have it, they took it anyway, and then they were just plunged into sin. You know, here this sin nature we have now. And then they have a son who murders a son. I wondered if that kind of ate at Adam all along. That this is my doing. Same way David's looking at this. Now, this doesn't negate our own guilt. I'm not trying to say that we're not responsible for our own sin, no more than Absalom is responsible for his actions here. But this was really started when David committed that sin with Bathsheba and murdered Uriah way back when. Now, Joab, there's two things I want to talk about here. Joab is a real unique character. If you read after him or try to figure, you can't really figure out what side of the fence Joab's on sometimes. But just keep your distance from him if you ever run into him. Joab is both, Del Ralph Davis says this, Joab is both right and wrong. He is both rebellious and he's both reasonable. You know, and he read these situations right almost all along. You know, he knew that David cared for his son more than he cared for them. If we, let me read the next chapter, 19, 1 through 8. We'll give Todd a head start when he comes back next week, since he's a little puny anyway. He's going to need some help, right? 19, 1 through 8. It was told to Joab, behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom. So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people, and the people heard that day the king is grieving for his son. And the people stole into the city that day as people steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. So what he's saying there is they got frightened in battle and they just kind of left. They fled in battle and they're kind of sneaking back into the city so no one knows that they were actually left the battlefield. They snuck back in the city. Verse 4, the king covered his face and cried with a loud voice, O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son. Then Joab came into the house of the king and said, you have today covered with shame the faces of your servants, because they were creeping in as those who were ashamed, right? So they were ashamed. You have this day, I'm talking about the servants, this day have saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines. Because, David, you love those who hate you and you hate those who love you. You have made it clear today to the commanders and the servants that we are nothing. That we are nothing to you, David. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, then you would be pleased. So that's what Joab read, and he seems to be right. He's right that David was willing to risk all his men's life for the sake of his son. who was a rebel, who was a traitor, who had killed his own son, his oldest son Amnon, his brother. So you see, and Joab seems to read that right. Joab seems to read it right when he wouldn't send Ahimaaz to deliver the news. He knew that Ahimaaz probably couldn't bear to bring the news to David. Joab seems to read some of these situations well. Now, he's a little ruthless in how he carries some of these things out. And then as we get to David, this is kind of interesting to me. You know, David had an older son, Amnon. Now, David's a fantastic story. There's a lot we can learn from him, but he had some shortcomings, you know, unlike the King of Kings, who has no shortcomings. David has some shortcomings. You know, and one of them, in my mind, is his parenting skills or his responsibility as a father. He just doesn't seem to have that. And so we all have our strong suits and our weak points, and we need to try to learn from others before us. But he had, at this time, his second oldest son was Amnon. You know, Amnon raped Tamar, and David seemed to do nothing about it. Well, he didn't do anything about it. He didn't do anything to Amnon. He didn't do anything for Tamar, you know, who was shunned after the whole deal. He didn't do anything to kind of comfort her or do anything along those lines. He did nothing to Absalom when he murdered Amnon. He didn't even want to do anything to Absalom during battle. He didn't want to do anything to Absalom. And when he has another son named Adonijah, look at this real quick. 1 Kings is the very next book, 1 Kings chapter 1. This shows you, you know, where Solomon says, there's nothing new under the sun. Adonijah took a play out of his brother Absalom's playbook. 1 Kings, the very next book, chapter 1, verse 5. Now, Adonijah, the son of Agith, that must be David's wife or concubine, because Adonijah is David's son. He exalted himself and said, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. Isn't that exactly what Absalom done? You know, he had those men and those horses, and they went before him and kind of proclaimed, here comes the king or the prince or whatever. Exactly like Absalom. And look what it says about David. His father, David, had never at any time displeased him, Adonijah, by asking, why have you done this and so? David seems, like it's saying right here, David at no time ever corrected this young man. Why have you done this? David never said it. Why have you done this? He never seemed to correct Adonijah. He never seemed to correct Absalom. He never seemed to correct Amnon. We can't follow this pattern, guys. I mean, David gives us a lot we can follow, but we need to care more for our kids than what David seems to do here. He seems to just kind of have a hands-off approach. Maybe he's too worried about the kingdom. Maybe he's too worried about the temple. I don't know where David's mind is, but it's not on raising these kids up in fear and admonition of the Lord. So, pray that we have a decent understanding of Absalom, how he rose to power for a short period of time. He met his demise in the forest of Ephraim. And now it seems like we're turning a new leaf, and he's going to have a younger brother that does this later on. So the sword shall never depart from your house. That's what the Lord told David, and he meant every word of it. So if you would, please stand. Brother Tim, would you?